G'day legends, welcome to episode 94 in 2024, the first effort 2024. It's great to be back. We had a couple of weeks off, which was nice, but we're back into our normal format, and I hope you all had a lovely break, if you did get a break. And I can feel it in my veins right now. This year is going to be the year of clinical excellence, the year of mastery, until next year, and then that's going to be the best year. But I hope it's all a good year, and you're feeling refreshed and ready for a good week back at work. I know, which was surprising that most people went back this week. We went back last week, but the majority of people I've spoken to have gone back this week. So hopefully feeling lovely and refreshed. So we'll be back to our fortnightly basis. One I wanted to do as a quick housekeeping, because our Patreon case study series is having a little bit of a change in format. Basically, what we're going to do is do a fortnightly longer format podcast with a guest. And then in between that, we're going to do a week focus on the Patreon, which is, as we've done before, research reviews. We're going to do some video content as well, where we're going to be in the gym going through some things that, and some cues and ways that we would help people get to a, you know, work on a deficit or get to a certain movement standard. So as an example, in a couple of weeks, we have one coming out of just a plyometric progression. Someone that can't double leg jump, how do we get them to that point? And what would the progressions and cues look like? Plus some series of cases where, you know, real examples that we're going through in the clinic and imaging and clinical reasoning and what we would do and why and kind of the outcome. So it's a bit of a journey to follow along for. And there's some really cool, interesting ones in there. So I think that'll be really enjoyable. So all that, those links are in the show notes. Otherwise, it is time for the first one of 2024. But we are not talking anything about 2024. We're talking about 2023. So we're going to go through all the episodes that we did and just some of the highlights that we took down, that we wrote down, that we spoke about on the podcast, and also just what Kelly and I spoke about. Anyway, just some of those really cool one-liners where, you know, as an example from which really talking about the distribution of bone stress injuries, proximal versus distal, and potentially why one may be more susceptible to things like red S and why that matters for us clinically. And then we talk, which is the most fun to talk about, the philosophical stuff, the things that we reflected on as clinicians that we want to try and work on and change this year, and things that we, you know, continue to work on all the time. So enjoy, you absolute legends, and we will speak in a couple of weeks. Welcome back to the Sports Medicine Project, the very first episode of 2024, but we're not talking anything 2024, we're talking 2023 this episode. We're going to be talking about everything that we learned, that we reflected on, all about the podcast, all about us as clinicians, philosophical stuff. But before we get into it, welcome to my co-host, Kelly. Welcome to 2024 of the Sports Medicine Project. How are you doing?
I'm good. I have still been riding 2023 on everything. You know, when you first get into the new year, and it took me about 4 days to realize on all my management plans, when I see a new patient and I write a little spiel on what the injury is, that I was still riding 2023. So I'm on the 2024 bandwagon now, and I have caught up.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good to be doing that.
To be writing 2024.
Yeah, that's a good start. Good start to the year. I haven't had that happen yet, but I do know what you mean when you feel as though you're just so used to writing the same thing. I guess I just don't write the date much. But anyway, before we get into the episode, being the start of the year, most people are going to be hearing this just as they're starting their first week. You either, I'm assuming you went back potentially last week if you're listening to this, or you might be starting this week. But what do you think is going to be your number one? What are you going to focus on this year? 2024, you're coming into your you're in that next stage. You're past a 0 to 5 year. Now you're in that next stage where you are the expert, because obviously once you get over that time, you automatically become the guru, the expert. No, I'm only kidding. But what are you going to focus on this year? What's the number one?
Well, you've put me on the spot.
And I've purposely done that, not said it to you, because I don't want you to think too much about it, because I just want you to... You almost do think of something that you need to get better at, and I guess healthcare is ever evolving, but what do you think?
Well, we just listened to a podcast on patient visit average, so maybe spending a little bit more time having a think about and looking into what my patient visit average is, and like cancellation rates and did not arrive rates and all of those sorts of things, and maybe just have a little reflect on some of the KPIs that are commonly spoken about.
The dirty word, KPIs.
Yeah, I know it is a bit of a dirty word, but it is relevant in a lot of ways. And I think it is, you know, if you look at it, I think if you look at it every day, then that's a problem. But if you look at the last 2 years and just sort of see if there's any trends or if there's any patterns, if there's any times in the year where you do better, if there's times in the year where you don't do as well, like maybe have a think about that and work out what the difference could be and what you could do. So maybe I'm going to write down some things that I could do to get those KPIs a little bit better.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough subject in business, and we certainly aren't qualified as much as many. We've both done some business courses, and we find that stuff interesting because I guess it is the reality of healthcare. We are in a business, and certainly when you start off as a new health professional and potentially into your first couple of years, you maybe don't think about it as much if you haven't had any history of learning about business. But it's important to understand what a balance sheet is and services and overheads and costs, because the biggest thing I find with students, and I know that there's students listening to this now, well, they're not students, they're all graduated, which is good, but understanding the cost of just running your business and how that portrays with billings and that kind of thing. Just stuff like that's always important. And what, PBA is as well.
What are you going to do this year?
Yeah, so I feel a bit like I've cheated because I've been thinking about it a little bit more. I'm going to, as much as possible, try to really critically think about the research and the studies and the information that I take in to be able to have it as translatable to clinical practice as possible. I think more and more I'm finding the importance of that, and I really want to put more time and effort into that, and not saying these broad sweeping statements without, which I usually don't do anyway, but without saying the nuances with it or thinking about it critically. So I guess research translation to a degree, really to a clinical practice.
I think you're good at that when you do all your social media posts. I think that they tend to summarize that really well. So I'll look forward to seeing how you make that even better.
Yeah, you can join if you want. If you want to come in the office and do some research translation too, you are free to use the big monitor. If you would like to, you can come in.
I get so overwhelmed. Blake has like 3 different screens, and then the mouse goes across all of them, and it's so hard to figure it all out.
Imagine this.
Content with my little Windows $600 laptop. Yeah, maybe $500. $600 might even be a bit generous.
Yeah, that thing. I cannot wait for that thing to explode so you can get a Mac and we can just be all Apple.
You want this to explode so you can hand me down your Mac and you can get a new one.
That would be nice, wouldn't it? Would you take the new Mac? Would you take my old Mac?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I've got a nice relationship with my computer. I really do. I think that could even be something that we look at in the next couple of weeks.
No, you don't need one. I just want a new one now. I shouldn't have said that. I planted the seed.
I've got to admit, completely off topic, having a Mac, I've had this one for, I think, 3 years now. No, potentially two and a half to 3 years. I mean, you do pay a price for them, but I haven't noticed much of a difference with speed, with how it looked, how it worked. And I've, you know, podcast audio, video audio, do lots of editing on there, and it still goes really well. The battery's really good. It's still quick. I really can't fault it much at all.
I wish we could say we were sponsored by Apple, but we're not.
Oh, imagine that. Ben, I would say if Apple emailed me and said, we will give you a Mac every year. Yeah. You know how they talk about that ethical dilemma where someone offers you a product and then you're, you know, going to endorse it. I think I'd have to bend my morals a little bit. I'd be saying anything they want about a Mac if they were to send me a Mac.
But you'd back it. Like, everything we own is Apple, apart from my laptop.
Yeah, well, I don't have an Apple Watch anymore. I've got the Garmin Watch.
True. Would you go back over to the Apple side? They've got the Dive computer on the Apple Watch. Yeah,
that would be nice. No, I do like
it. Anyways, we're going off topic. This podcast is already going to go for a long time, I reckon, because we've got a freaking lot of stuff to talk about because we learnt so many things. So I'm going to kick things off with a snippet or a concept that we learnt from, or a fact rather, from Dr. Richard Willey. It was, I think, the first podcast that we released of 2023, maybe. Very early on in 2023. And this is something that we've quoted a few times over the last year, but I'm going to do it again because I think it's awesome to learn about. So the closer that we are to the ground, the more biomechanics matter. The further away we are from the ground, the more energy availability matters. And that's in the context of bone stress injuries. So the trabecular bone, which is typically more proximal or further away from the ground, is very metabolically active, and therefore it may be more likely to be a bone stress injury in that region may be more likely to have some sort of low energy availability issue. Crazy, hey?
Yeah. Did you say that again? You were saying, I don't know if I zoned out or not. You're saying that trabecular bone is more metabolically active, so it's more susceptible if you're in a state of low energy availability. Is that what you said?
I think so.
I don't know if you said that. I swear you just said something. I just went in a circle.
And I kind of felt thing. Like I went in a circle.
Yeah, because I was waiting for you and I'm like, you didn't. That's the best bit that you didn't. I didn't feel like you said, but then I thought I might have zoned out.
But I think I said all the important parts, but I might have said it twice.
Yeah. Just doubled it up. Yeah, that's a good start. Good start. But yeah, that's something that definitely goes without saying, but it's always individualized. It's not always a matter of if someone comes in with a foot bone stress injury or below knee bone stress injury, it's just the biomechanics, or if someone comes up with the proximal, it's just the red or low energy availability. And I think like your case was a good example where when you had, you know, whether we call it a bone stress injury or a shaft bone stress injury or periosteum, you did the, you know, some blood screens, everything was all normal, and we're like, no, it can't just be load. Surely not. There's got to be some other stuff going on because we learn and talk so much about it, but it wasn't the case at all. It was purely, well, it seems most likely it was purely just a load imbalance between how much you were doing and how much the bone was recovering.
Yeah. I mean, there might have been some sort of, there might have been like a, because I remember Katie Schofield said in the podcast we did with her in 2022, she was saying that you only have to be in a state of low energy availability for 5 days before your hormones could be impacted. And, you know, during that time we were moving houses and things like that. So I wonder if that might have just been that short window where it suffered a little bit. But overall hormones and everything like that was good. So that's good. All right. So number two, I think this is a really cool one to think about as well, because I often get a little bit confused about when the sacrum develops a bone stress injury, or when people get sacral bone stress reactions and how that can happen, because it just seems like, you know, you've got all these other bones before it sort of reaches the sacrum. So why don't they get impacted? But the way that Rich Willey explained this was really cool. So he described it as the sacrum being like a ring. And so when a ring is loaded, the load is sort of distributed across the entire ring. So even though the sacrum may not be getting a huge amount of direct force while running, because there's other bones that might be getting more sort of peak impact loads, but it is getting a lot of that repetitive and accumulative load, because every single step the entire sacrum is subject to some sort of load, and on either step as well. So it's not just like on, for example, like the left tibia gets load when the left foot strikes the ground. The sacrum will get load when the right and the left foot strike the ground. So it's pretty much gets double the amount of accumulative load.
Yeah. I've loved, like, my third learning, which ties into this, is understanding the way that bones are loaded and the different loads that can be applied to them and how that relates to the injury that's presenting. And like that's a good example. I definitely do not see any sacrum be assigned, so I'm not going to speak about that. I'm going to speak about the tibia, which is when we're talking about, say, something like a tibial BSI, like an anterior cortex versus the posterior aspect of the tibia. When you're hitting the ground, you're going to have more tensile load applied to the front of the bone as it's bending versus more compressive at the back of the bone. And that's one of the factors that contributes to those anterior cortex ones taking so long to heal, because you've got a fracture area or an area that's been under stress trying to heal and it's being loaded in that tensile way. You imagine like a stick trying to bend.
Yeah.
And now on my, I don't think I told you this, but on my Instagram, my Instagram reels are now coming up with all this like engineering stuff of like bits of metal and concrete getting bending with the lines, because that's what the stuff that I've been interested in. Yeah. And I'm like, and it makes complete sense. So like bend something and you can see all the loads are applied to it, but it's really cool. And a good example, which I posted about on the Instagram, is the same concept applied to the navicular, where as you load the midfoot, the arch, and the plantar fascia elongate, arch comes down. Because the navicular is almost like a C shape, as you're loading it, it pulls away from the bone when it's trying to remodel and heal. Plus, it's a relatively avascular area. But just some cool biomechanical stuff. Mm. Yeah.
Wait, there are instances where biomechanics really matter.
Yeah, well, I guess it...
Or
I
not, mean, wait, maybe that's not biomechanics. Is that kinetics?
So think of
kinematics.
Yeah, kinematics, movement you can see with your eyes. Kinetics is movement that you can't see.
So
someone pronating would be their kinematics. Their kinetics would be the internal forces acting upon the joints. But really, it doesn't matter too much. But yeah, that whole biomechanics, man, that would be a good podcast to talk about.
All right, number four.
Wait, on that, is there anything that you, just from that, has that changed your clinical practice at all? Or, I guess in your recommendations, or has it just really changed how you understand bone stress injuries and perhaps give you more confidence when managing them?
I think a lot of things that I've learned, or a lot of things that have happened over the last 12 months have changed how I think about bone stress injuries. So that whole entire podcast I learned heaps from. Rich Willey's course that we went to, I learned heaps from. And also my own experience with a bone stress injury as well. And learning about, I did have to do a presentation on medial tibial stress syndrome and learning a bit more about that. So there's been a lot of things that have sort of changed my view on bone stress injuries and how I would approach them and manage them. So I wouldn't say it's any one thing. I think it's just all of that.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say it's just changed the way I think about life. Like could go like really broad.
Just really change
your whole perspective. Yeah, change your whole perspective on life. You want to hit us with number four?
Yeah. So again, something that Blake and I harp on often, that sports specialization or early sports specialization is a major risk factor for bone stress injury in adolescence. And it was good to refresh my memory on what that sort of means, because you hear the word like sports specialization and you're like, you kind of wonder how specialized do they have to be for that to become a risk factor. And so that was actually well defined by it being adolescent running nine months per year and not participating in any other sports. I think that's pretty extreme version of it. So any other participation in sports and having a little bit more rest throughout the year, I suppose, is doesn't put you in that category.
This one has definitely changed a lot of my education with parents. Do see quite a few pediatrics in the clinic, I guess pediatrics and adolescents, but I spend a good chunk of time speaking to mums and dads about sport specialization, but even the watered down version, because like you said, that's a pretty significant amount of training. But it makes logical sense that as pediatrics and adolescents are going through those developmental years, growth plates are changing, extracellular matrix are changing in their tendons, their body is just changing a lot, it would make sense that the more different stresses and strains you can expose them to and the more variability should perhaps lead them to have potentially a more robust musculoskeletal system when they're older. And I've been saying that a lot to parents, and I also use it as a justification where if they have a little bit of, you know, heel pain or knee pain and, you know, Sever's or Osgood or something happening in their feet, in most cases for these kids, it's not enough to stop them from their sport. And it's a good justification to explain with parents that, hey, while they're going through their developmental years, if, you know, they're enjoying their sport, we know it's safe to load their heel and their knee and their foot, it's going to be really good now because it's awesome to be active, but it's also going to be good for their long-term health. So having a couple of months off to let the heel settle potentially is an option, but it's probably going to be better if we know that we're safe and you're okay with that and they're okay with that, to continue to sport sample and be active, and that's probably the best thing for them.
I find the majority of kids would, though. Like, in Australia anyways, we have PE, we have sport. Kids have to participate in different sports during all of primary school and high school.
And not
but
so
I wonder
much
if that's, like, considered enough.
Yeah, I guess where I'm coming from is not so much for the kids, but for the parents, because they're the one that are most concerned.
No, I was just adding that as a different point.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I just basically continue to say that it's really important that they do lots of different sports and lots of different activities, and that's my justification. And I kind of build upon this sport specialization stuff where, like, hey, if you just did this one thing, there's nothing wrong with that, but if you're happy to do multiple things, it's probably going to be better. Because I could see the other argument of, like, imagine saying that to someone, let's say there's a really competitive, and I'm thinking of someone that I saw last year, a really competitive young runner who has had some injuries, but they are quite competitive. How difficult is that going to be to have the conversation with their parents and say, hey, I know they're doing really well and they really enjoy it, but you're probably not going to go and do something else.
Mm.
It's a hard conversation to have. And you're definitely speaking with the parents more, but obviously including everyone in the consult.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting though.
All right, do you want to roll into the next one? I feel like you harp on about this one fairly often, so off you go.
Yeah. So the episode with Peter Maliara, speaking about we may not always need heavy resistance for tendinopathy management, and I have to admit I've certainly changed my view on this, both through the research, but also just patient experiences as well, and knowing that some people just do well with some movement, whether it be medium loads or high loads, or if it's dry needling, or if it's massage, or if it's anything. People can really get better and do the things they want to be able to do in some cases without having to do heavy resistance training for their tendinopathy. However,
For pain.
But, and that's the caveat to that, is when it comes to function, if there is a deficit between the demands they're placing on the tissue and what they can currently do, well, then you need to be able to bridge that gap. And heavy resistance training is such a good way to do that.
Mm-hmm. And the more heavy load that you're going to be placing on that tendon, the greater amount of tendon strain, which is what tendons essentially need for healthy adaptation.
Yes. Yeah. I think the heavy loading stuff I've found difficult at times purely based off access.
Access?
Yeah. I mean,
I've even found that myself lately. We sold at work our Smith machine, which I used to use for all my heavy calf raises. So now all I've been able to do is hold onto a dumbbell and it's not enough. Like I can do heavier calf raises than what I can hold in terms of my grip. And then I try and do it with a barbell and it's just kind of awkward and hard to do. So yeah, I get that. Definitely.
I find it for patients as well. Like
I was just meaning we've got access to full on gyms and I find it hard. So So certainly people that don't have a gym, like any sort of gym access, how do they do it?
Yeah. And I find people develop, it must be, you know, a neural adaptation and the skill, they can develop out of the body weight kind of the body weight constraint quite quickly. Like if you're seeing them for some time, which is typical for a tendinopathy, especially an Achilles tendinopathy, and especially if they've had it for a long time, you know, you might be seeing them in some cases for 12 months. If you're trying to load that tendon, they can move away from body weight pretty quickly. And then if they don't have access to a gym and they don't have a step at home, or they do have a step at home, it is hard to add weight.
Mm,
yeah. What do you find? What do you do there? you just have them carry something or hold something or go and purchase some weights or try and have access to a gym, because then that's a whole other barrier as well.
Yeah. And then just progress to like jumping and hopping and other things, which is different, but...
Yeah, it's still increasing tendon strength, and it relates to what they want to get back to as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the higher intensity stuff is better for tendon strain and then developing tendon adaption.
Huh?
From that episode from Peter O'Malley, I was talking about higher intensity, like progressing someone along the continuum of, you know, isometrics and isotonics and then to hopping and jumping and that kind of thing. What's your opinion?
Well, I think the hopping and the jumping is more just the functionality of the tendon rather than putting the tendon through strain, because I think that to put the tendon through a high amount of strain, it kind of needs to be lengthened.
Lengthened under load.
Yeah, I think so.
That's a good question. There would definitely be a study on that, because I imagine, because tendons are viscoelastic, the longer or the more elongation they go through, the stiffer they get. But then does stiffness automatically equate to strain, to that adaption?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's what the function is of a tendon. So you'd assume that jumping and hopping would be helping them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Possibly. But it's interesting talking about the heavy resistance stuff, because it gives you a little bit more confidence, you know, advising someone and explaining to them that it's, you know, it's okay and feasible to go through just some body weight calf raises. I still, probably the number one thing I iterate to people, which is always the thing that I think all struggle with our patient, is just compliance and making sure they're consistent.
Mm.
And I probably changed my mind a little bit, where I think, you know, whether the loads are that heavy, depending on the deficit, but in general, whether the loads are heavy or medium or low, it's probably more important that they're just consistent with whatever they're doing and consistent with that over the long term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keeping to the topic of tendons, we also interviewed Ebony Rio this year, and some of the main takeaways from her was that we don't know what the nociceptive driver is of tendinopathy. What we think the cause of pain could be is that, I might let you explain this because I think you do a good job of explaining the ion channels better than me. And I've heard you explain it very succinctly before, so I'd rather you.
I haven't explained it in a while, and I'll try and keep it super simple, mostly because I don't think I'm going to be able to explain it very, very well, but we'll see how we go and if I can make some sense of it. And hopefully I don't butcher it. So the ion channels within tendon or within bone are like sensors. Now they detect, you know, the chemical and the mechanical environment. They give information to the nerve, which then gives it to the spinal cord and the brain, and that's the afferent nerve. So we seem to think, potentially in tendons and bones, there are ion channels that perhaps drive this more. And then when you're warming up or when the pain's coming the next day, what may be happening is those ion channels can't take any more change, can't detect the substance, and then, you know, so forth to the nerve, the spinal cord, and to the brain. So let's say I've had enough, it warms up, you're not giving that drive of nociception. And then the next day, when, you know, you're waking up and things have settled down, all those substances potentially are still there, but you've got to go back and listen to the episode. But that's one of the theories that could be potentially happening.
Mm. And then as we adapt over time, we produce fewer ion channels to be stimulated. So that's an indication that, you know, our pain can eventually change, is again following on that theory as to maybe why tendinopathy does get better and how. Something else that Ebony mentioned, and I think it's quite interesting because Keith Barr kind of contradicted it at the same time. So a Haglund's morphology being a mechanical advantage of the tendon to lever off the bone. And then I remember when we interviewed Keith Barr, he sort of dismissed that idea and suggested that a Haglund's morphology is not great for, like, it's not a good indication of health of the tendon. And I wonder if that's because he tends to look at, you know, the tendon as being like a tendinopathy at its sort of cellular level. And then Ebony looks at it more as a sort of like pain and function and being able to do the things that you want to do. So I wonder if it's just that sort of difference in perspective at that. But I did find that quite interesting as well. I like the idea of it being a mechanical advantage, and that's certainly what I would tell my patients as well. I wouldn't say that it's not very good for them or it's indicating bad health, because at the end of the day, you're not going to change it. So I'd rather be giving the patient confidence and encouraging movement and load rather than the opposite of that.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that you called it Hagelin's morphology, because that is what I call it now. And, you know, if we understand that words and the way we speak and how we present information to people matters so much, that is such a simple, easy thing to change. And whether it is truly a deformity or a morphology, Ebony explained in the podcast that she seems to believe it's a morphology because that's a response to bone, and that's what the definition of a morphology is. Mm-hmm. And it, like, that little small change makes such a difference.
Yeah. And then another thing that she says that just, again, brings so much more confidence to our structure, even if it doesn't seem to look very good on imaging. She describes, you know, calcification within the tendon as being the result of having spring, which is, you know, tensile loads and compressive loads applied to the tendon, and the best substance being calcification. Best substance being calcium? Is that what that means? What's the bone? Or like the best substance being bone is what that would be within developing within the tendon to be able to tolerate those loads. So again, it'd be interesting to hear what Keith Barr's perspective on that would be, because I would imagine that my assumption would be that that would be not an ideal tendon in his eyes. But yeah, I think that the way that Ebony explains it is really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's such an easy thing to think of. I mean, I've had a couple of these conversations with patients who want to talk about why they have these changes and why the tendon's a little bit thicker and the environment that we subject it to. And it makes a lot of sense, I think. And obviously there's a lot more happening on a cellular level, but that's pretty easy to understand. And for us as clinicians, it makes sense as well, potentially why people develop, you know, these types of presentations.
Yeah.
Now, you want to talk about Caitlin Daly, because you listened to this one as I recorded.
I listened to it after you recorded them. Yeah. And I learned some things from it, because these are things that I definitely didn't know and things that I have actually taken into my clinical practice. So prolapse signs, such as like that heaviness or that feeling of coming down through the pelvic floor, doesn't actually occur at the time of exercise, but in the 24 hours afterwards. So that is so relevant to me and my work that I do clinically, because I do a lot of rehab with, you know, men and women, but often, you know, there's women that have had babies in their history, or there might be some sort of history or relevance to this. And, you know, I'm assuming that if they aren't reporting this to me at the time, then they must be fine and they can continue to crack on. However, some of those signs tend not to develop until the 24 hours afterwards. So it made me realize that I need to be checking in on how they responded to that session, you know, the next time I see them, and just being mindful if there is anything like that they are saying.
How are you checking in? Like let's say there was a male potential, and they would learn about this, and you know, this is from a physio point of view or an EP point of view, or anyone that does, I guess, rehab and group classes. How do you check in? Do you just ask?
I just say, how did you go after our last session? Any soreness? Body felt okay? Next day, no concerns or anything like that, and I'll just leave it open to them.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I'm not treating anyone specifically for prolapse, so I'm not going to ask them if they've got any of those specific signs. I've opened the question, and if they feel comfortable to ask, open up or disclose that with me, then they can.
Yeah, great.
And then the other thing that I think is really interesting is that we don't need women to do pelvic floor exercises between 0 to 6 weeks postpartum. So from 6 weeks on, it's recommended, and this can be associated with reduced pelvic floor dysfunction. But yeah, from 0 to 6 weeks, no worries. Don't need to.
Mm. And that follows into Anthony Lowe's podcast as well, which was a real
combination of everything in there. That was a really good one. So make sure you go back and listen to part one and part two. But this is something that I've seen on social media, and I'm not giving too many pelvic floor cues, but he was saying that not everyone needs a pelvic floor cue, and a lot of people are on unconsciously confident. So we don't need to pull people back to like a conscious confidence.
Yeah. And so if someone is, so to follow on from that, like if someone is playing a game of tennis and they're able to run and jump and change direction and they're not getting any leakage or any incontinence signs, then you don't need to pull them back to, you know, crook lying basic pelvic floor activation work, because they're tolerating it. Okay. So you're basically just taking, you know, steps backwards.
Mm. Yeah. I found listening to those, I mean, it's always difficult to, I guess, devoting time and energy listening to an episode or a person that's going to be presenting information that it's very easy to think that it's not going to be relevant. But I mean, I just enjoy listening to people talk about the human body as a pretty blanket rule anyway. But that stuff has been interesting for patients that potentially make a comment about someone else that they're seeing or what they're doing or some experience they've had. And although I'm not speaking about it with them for very long or really that directly, I do have an understanding of what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a couple of patients recently who are seeing women's health physio, and it's just interesting to hear how they're going and what they're doing, and I can actually have a conversation about it. It doesn't feel taboo, and I don't feel like, oh, I can't talk about this. I've got no idea what's mm-hmm. actually happening. But I wonder if that helps the like people develop somewhat of a bit more of a therapeutic reliance and trust and rapport. Like, oh, I can, you know, speak with my health professional about this stuff and how it's going, and just another ear to listen to.
Yeah. Another thing that Anthony talked about in the podcast that I find really interesting as well is the talk that sit-ups are really bad, and how people talk about sit-ups being non-functional and all of that sort of jazz. And I just think that's a lot of the time not necessarily true. Sit-ups are more often than not quite safe, and before putting a, you know, a blanket ban on an exercise, just assess the person and see if they can tolerate it. And that also ties into a rectus diastasis, so that's the separation of the linea alba, in often postpartum, but can be in other cases as well. And again, this was something that I thought was really interesting. So there can be hard doming or there can be soft doming. And so hard doming is when there's a lot of tension on the tissue between the rectus abdominis, and they're the ones that you need to be a bit more careful with loading. So if you compare that to, say, an Achilles tendon, that would be an Achilles tendon, say, on the most amount of stretch or tension, and where it would be, say, more likely to tear, if so, compared to a soft doming rectus diastasis, where there's very minimal tension on that space between the rectus abdominis, and it's actually really safe to load. So you can just palpate the person's linea alba, or that space where the linea alba is, and just feel if it feels hard or if it feels quite soft and squishy. So again, relating that to an Achilles tendon, where that might be a little bit more comfortable for you guys. So an Achilles tendon isn't going to snap when it's taken off stretch. So if you go into plantar flexion and your Achilles tendon is quite like loose, it's very unlikely for your Achilles to rupture in that position. It's more likely for it to rupture, say, when it's at maximal stretch position. So that's the way that you could think about hard doming versus soft doming, and whether you can, you know, load it or not. Not that you can't load an Achilles tendon on stretch, but yeah, that was the example that he gave, and I thought that was really, really cool.
Yeah, great episode. Go back and have a listen to that one. Yeah, our episode with Keith Barr on tendons, which was a very popular episode, had lots of feedback from that one. It was one of the most interesting episodes we've done on the podcast, and yeah, I don't even really feel the amount of information that was in that podcast, I don't even feel as though I've digested it at all. And I've listened to it a couple of times, and I've tried to take some information and some notes, but there was just a lot happening and a lot of information all at once. But the one thing that was really interesting, talking about the stress shielding, but the idea that isometrics are able to treat potentially the degenerative part of the tendon. So when you're loading the tendon in that isometric position, you have a relaxation of the strain around the degenerative part of the tendon, and then the strain would then basically occur on that degenerative part. And if you can load it, you can maybe change it and almost reverse it. He speaks about it, not, you know, there not being any robust studies on that, but
in humans,
but the ability to potentially reverse or change a degenerative part of the tendon is pretty cool and turn it back into healthy tendon, because it was once thought, I guess still is thought, and that is the leading theory, that once you have a degenerative part, you know, the tendon around it can become as healthy and healthier and make up for that degenerative part. But there was the thought that you weren't able to change that.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, I like that one. Now, David Hunter talking about osteoarthritis. The biggest learning I got from this, and again, changing my clinical practice, is the amount of time and energy that I'm dedicating to speaking to people about the other factors that contribute to potentially worsening of OA or the symptoms of their function. So, of course, I'm not in any way disputing that there's no mechanical stuff that we need to worry about, but it's typically a condition that people live with, and it's a condition that people have to manage, and there's not a whole lot of options out there. But someone having an understanding about maintaining the things he talks about, a healthy weight and a good overall systemic health system, I think I probably didn't dedicate as much time as I used to talking about how and why that's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was a really great episode. I think there were so many good takeaways from that. And it's such a common condition that we are all seeing every day. I would guess there'd be someone that you see that has some form of osteoarthritis. And I think it's something that could all get better at treating and explaining and, just working together as a team to try and improve the outcomes of the people in front of us.
Yeah, and it's important because a lot of the things that we can do in the clinic aren't going to be potentially what people think that we're going to be able to do. Like, let's say with a plantar fascia or a tendon or something else that's a bit more acute, it's very likely that you're going to be able to have a complete resolution of symptoms and full function and not have any issues, you know, and you not ever think about it again. But with this condition, a lot of the things that we can do, although they can help, if someone's thinking that it's just going to be like any other injury where their pain is going to be gone and their function is going to be completely returned to exactly where they want it to be, that might not be the case. And from what we understand about the condition, a lot of people live with disability and reduced function and mobility and pain. Yeah. So,
and only about 10% of people with osteoarthritis actually need a replacement. That was so interesting to learn as well, because, you know, I had a patient last week who came in and she was an older lady having this anterior hip pain, stiff in the mornings, all the classic signs of hip osteoarthritis. And I said to her, look, I think that it might be, you know, a bit of osteoarthritis that you're experiencing. And the reaction from her was very large, like, oh, this is the worst news ever. And I was like, no, it's okay. Like, this is going to be okay. There's actually not that many, you know, it's not an indication that you need to, you know, rush in to see a specialist right now. It's very manageable. And there's a lot of things that we can do for it first, and gave her all these, you know, options and discussed it with her in length. And I think there's certainly, yeah, that stigma or that stereotype in the community about osteoarthritis being worst case scenario, and I don't think it needs to be, so I hope that can change.
Yeah, one idea I think, and we're going to talk about this as kind of the next part of it, like our philosophical learnings and understandings from 2023, but on the topic of OA, you know, we a lot of the time think of surgery as it's the absolute last resort. Like, if everything has failed, we'll try everything else but you getting an opinion from a specialist or an orthopedic surgeon, and then you'll see them and everything else has failed. And I think patients and people having a discussion with them earlier isn't probably certainly not a bad thing, but it's something that I think is really important in this condition. So trying to have the other side as well. So not saying that, yeah, everyone needs a hip or a knee replacement, but potentially some people will just get a really good result, or they just want to do that and they don't want to try anything else. So there's still value in them having an opinion and discussion with an orthopod, and that's just trusting and utilizing the people that that you trust.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So our philosophical learnings, you want to kick us off or you want me to kick off?
No, you go. This is, you were excited about this part.
Yeah, because this is the stuff that, this stuff holds true forever. Mm-hmm. So this will be the stuff. Next year, we could have another awesome tendon researcher come on and tell us that, you know what, we got it wrong. Dry needling is the thing that fixes the degenerative part of the tendon. So this stuff that we talk about can always change, and it does always change, but the philosophical stuff, the things that make you as a clinician and your principles, those things change as well. But those are the things that are always going to hold true, I guess, as you update them. You know what I mean? So,
but they might not. They might change.
Yeah, but like yeah, what no, you are
what
right.
you believe
you right.
this year might be different to next year.
Yeah, but
like next year you might say, nah, fuck resistance training. I'm just going to run. Resistance training doesn't even prevent injuries. So what's the point?
I don't, you're right, but I don't know how to actually refute what you're saying, but I'll just use an example and then hopefully it'll make sense.
We'll just have to revisit this next year and see if you still hold true to these ones.
So as an example and a good reflection from last year is, being comfortable and not hard on myself, but not satisfied with not being able to help everyone and understanding and knowing that healthcare is this journey that you're on forever, where you are constantly trying to get better and improve your outcomes and work collaboratively better with people. I think that a lot, but I really thought about it a lot when I was looking back on 2023.
And maybe that's just our way of justifying to ourselves that there's some patients that we just don't get.
Yeah, and this is the thing. This is why I brought it up, because that's the most common response where the two sides, imagine like a devil on one side and the angel on the other. On one side, it's like, yeah, you just sometimes it doesn't work or something goes wrong or it's just not going to work and that's just how it is. But on the other side, that's not a good way to think about it, because what if the actual case was there was something that you did that you could improve on, or there was something that you could do in just your systems and operations? Maybe your follow-ups weren't as good, or potentially you gave them too much exercise and that it flared them up and they didn't want to come back. Like, it's this divide between, there will be some cases that you just, you know, you don't potentially get the outcome that you're looking for, but it can't be an out to say that. Well, the way that I think about it is, it's not an out to say, oh yeah, some people we just don't get along with. But there are some people that will. Because if you think about it the other way, and I've explained this with the students all the time, you can't be too hard on yourself when you don't get the outcome that you potentially want, or you and the person that you're trying to help agreed upon, because you will always be down on yourself because we don't always get the outcomes that we want.
Mm. I think the way that I've gotten comfortable with this...
Hang on. But you need to be still wanting to improve and be better as a clinician. It can't be like, oh yeah, that person didn't get better with the dry needling. It doesn't worry. That's just, it's on them. It's like, well, maybe you need to update how you're treated or thinking, that kind of thing is the idea of it.
I was just going to say that I think I have gotten quite comfortable with this, just being in the clinic and the environment that I'm in, because we do a little bit of manual therapy as a symptom modification tool and to try and sort of provide evidence that their pain is changeable and that things can feel better and show them how they can replicate that themselves. But we are largely an active-based clinic with a lot of rehab and a lot of exercise prescription and not very manual therapy focused. And then there's some people that come in and I'll do a little bit of manual therapy with and massage and things like that. But if they're really wanting just manipulation and dry needling and massage, then I'm more than happy to give them recommendations and refer them to massage therapists that I trust and that I think will be good for them, rather than trying to help them with that, because I just don't think I'm the best person for it.
Mm. So then using the exact principle, my question to you would then be, if it makes sense and it's something that they, and not saying that they don't need that, but let's say, it's an easy example to think of, let's say it's a runner with an Achilles tendinopathy that wants to run an ultra marathon and they have a deficit in their calf, they have a deficit in their lower limb and all their strength and so forth. So, and they just want manual therapy. Is it then on you as a clinician to show them why they need to look at addressing the deficit if they want to be able to meet where they are.
Of course.
So then if someone does just want manual therapy, would you then not refer them?
No, I would always give it a crack. If someone came in just wanting manipulations and dry needling, I'd give it a good shot at trying to have that conversation with them about, you know, is it the dry needling and the manipulation that you want, or is it the effect or the relief that it gives you? And if it's okay with them, can I try doing something else that might give them the same sort of relief and then use that as a tool to try and sort of educate them towards exercise and addressing the deficit and how that might be more relevant to their pain. But in the same breath, if they also just wanted some sort of manual therapy, I would say, well, there's no harm in that. Here's the card to this person. Go book in and see them for a massage. At the same time, if you want to keep running, we've got to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm not a very good massage. I mean, you know, I suck at massages, so they probably don't want me to do that to them anyway.
Your little tiny hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard because then this, you know, putting in that energy to help change that narrative is difficult. And if you're doing that multiple times, sometimes several times a day, it can be draining. And I remember someone saying to me in my new graduate year, and I'll probably word it a bit better, but you say, you know, oh, just pick your battles. And I understand the premise, but I think the whole idea of this, or the start of this conversation, is it does take a lot of energy, and you just have to be smart where you do put your energy and your time when that's difficult. And that process, I don't think you ever really completely master. You just hopefully get better and better with it. Now, one thing as well, as a podiatrist, typically within our profession, and I think that most people would agree with me on this, our recommendations and advice, it's definitely improving, but you wouldn't go and see a podiatrist if you wanted to potentially do some strength and conditioning, or you wanted to get a program to, say, improve your running or get stronger or improve your deadlift or your squat and that kind of thing. So I guess the physical activity, and something that I really want to try and do and have been trying to do is, you know, helping people for what they're coming in for and what they want to get back to, but trying to create healthy habits and really focus on improving their health literacy in the long term. So if they're coming to see me for some plantar fasciopathy and we're talking about all the good things that, you know, that we can do, we can offload it, we can do some rehab, what the condition is, you know, footwear, taping, all those kinds of things. But in the long term, what also is going to be good, not just for your plantar fasciopathy, but for your overall systemic health, your cardiovascular health, your musculoskeletal health, is, you know, potentially trying to meet the physical activity guidelines or engaging in healthy habits and walking and moving and kind of using the heel pain as a bit of a, almost like the thing to jump from of, great, if we can get this improving and better, we can get you back to that 30 minutes of walking that you want to be able to do. And that's an awesome habit. And while we're also there, you know, why don't we also look at doing some other things that are great for your lower limb, like some calf raises and maybe some squats and some just movement stuff. And I really want to try and get good at recommending that and helping people understand why that's important. Like the example that I think of now is, which I see quite a lot of, is male over the age of 45 with an Achilles tendinopathy, or the master's athlete or the master's runner. And, you know, I'm explaining the reality to them that, you know, if you've had an Achilles tendinopathy, your risk of having it again is higher. Being a master's athlete, your risk is a little bit higher. And also being a male, your risk is a little bit higher. So even once this is better, for long-term good healthy habits, let's try and have a healthy strong calf and a healthy strong Achilles. So trying to have them understand why it's important that, yes, they should probably do some resistance training a couple of times a week. And then that leads me to my next part, which is resistance training is good for everything. It can't be disputed now for your metabolic markers, your tendon health, your calf health. Would you agree with this statement? Yes or no? Most human beings should be doing some form of resistance training based off...
No, I agree with that completely.
Yeah, based 100%. Off the evidence. And not just for like, yeah, if you do resistance training, it prevents your risk of getting Achilles. I'm not saying that at all. Just mm-hmm. for your overall health, your adipose tissue, your cognitive health, your mental health, your musculoskeletal health.
My honors, bone health. My honors project in uni was on the benefits of resistance training for women going through chemotherapy for breast cancer. Yeah. And, you know, everyone else's honors project, it's like very, you know, typical research, inconclusive, like need more evidence, blah, blah, blah. This, it was like,
yeah,
this is clear. What you need to do. There's a clear recommendation for resistance training for women with breast cancer undergoing chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and that's like a very, you know, specific population group, but everyone, I think, yeah, I think... Except it's pretty boring.
It is, and that is the most, it is the most challenging part. And I'm really tired of just seeing. It's important, I understand, to have these studies to show that it's important, but it's the same result every time. Yes, it's important. If we compare it to cardio or compare it to someone that doesn't do exercise, yes, it seems to be superior for overall. And they usually look at like metabolic markers, blood markers, that kind of thing. It's the next step of trying to help people understand why it's important. That's the part that we really struggle with. Or that's the part that I really struggle with.
I think it's just about making it fun for them in some way. So whether it be a class or whether it be... individual, you know, I think what I would need, if someone could develop like an outside gym, I reckon I could get around it a little bit more.
They're everywhere.
Outside?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
You go to like... No. You go to like every park in Newcastle, circuit.
But then how do you get your legs strong on those things? Can't do single leg pull-ups.
Single leg pull-ups.
Yeah.
What's a single leg pull-up?
I don't know, but there's nothing to do for legs.
Yeah, that's true. Those things aren't worthless. You can't even do a 200 kilo deadlift down there.
That's what I mean.
The machines they're pretty good. You can do dips and
all upper body though. What leg? Tell me one leg exercise.
We can do a calf raise, and there's little signs there's no there. Weight. Yeah, but
you can do a calf raise.
I know, but I think there's barriers to them leaving dumbbells and stuff there. I guess they could put a machine out there, but I think the premise of it is a good idea. And most people, as we were saying before, most people are going to get benefit from just going in there and doing some bodyweight stuff.
Yeah.
What are you going to rock up and say, you're doing your bodyweight calf raise? Get some loads. There's a little 65-year-old Ruth down there just trying to engage.
Outside gym setup thing, then I'd be more into it.
There are, I mean, they got chin up bars and stuff. Like the one, like down here in Lambton, there's the...
Yeah, I know. I need a barbell.
Yeah.
I need to do squats and deadlifts.
Yeah, you need like a whole like CrossFit studio.
Yeah.
Like, why don't they just have a full functioning gym outside for everyone to access? But yeah, I think that's something that I really want to try and work on. Now, the last one that we'll leave it with is the same idea of what is a successful treatment? What does it mean for someone to have a successful outcome? And I think when I was a practitioner first, you know, starting out, it was always no pain, full function. That is the only way someone can actually, like, if they don't get that, I've failed as a practitioner and it didn't improve. So I think for some, and I'm speaking purely for myself here, seeing cases of persistent pain more regularly and post-operative cases where people have had a trauma, say a car accident, or they've had reconstructive surgery, some people will have a limit on their, or a ceiling on their function, and some people will live with some pain, not to say for the rest of their lives, but potentially for the longer term. And sometimes having them understand and us come together to say what are potentially an A goal and a B goal and a C goal, and if someone is to get back to 10 minutes of walking or going to the gym or going to lunch with their friends with still pain, that can still be a win. And, you know, just coming together and understanding that potentially the pain resolution might not be something that we can get to in the short term, but that doesn't mean that we need to stop doing what we're doing. We just need to work at it for a little bit longer, and we'll try as much as we can to get it where we want it to get it.
Yeah, and I think it's about coming to that realization together, not just what you think. So I think it's about sort of like coaching the patient or asking them enough questions for them to realize that maybe they don't actually just want to be pain-free, but what they actually want is to be able to get up and down off the ground so they can play with their grandkids. And if they're in a little bit of pain to do that, then that's okay. Because a lot of the time patients think that they need to be out of pain to be able to do those things. So our job is to almost flip that a little bit on its head and say, well, what if you could do those things, but it was just a little bit uncomfortable? And they're like, oh, well, maybe that's okay. So yeah, I think that it's a lot of what we do is about sort of coaching people and just having those, you know, somewhat difficult conversations and having to craft them in a very particular way to, I guess, in a weird way, like manipulate the patient into understanding that, you know, being pain-free isn't necessarily what they actually want. What they actually want is the thing that they think they can't have because of it, if that makes sense.
And that is a very hard conversation to have without coming across saying that, hey, we're not going to get your pain better and stop focusing on it. Let's focus on your function. Like, it is difficult, and developing that relationship and going through it together and helping them out it's hard being that facilitator. And so that's going to be something that I thought about a lot when I looked back on the year.
I like that one. I reckon that was the winner out of all of that we just spoke about.
That was good. Yeah.
The best one to finish on, I think.
Yeah, nice, good. Well, let's finish it there, and we'll speak to you guys in a couple of weeks.